Good morning. Thank you for attending this session. My name is Dr. Gabrielle Windgasse. I'm with the California Department of Public Health and the Environmental Health Investigations Branch. And I will talk about engineered nanomaterials. Why is it so difficult to determine potential public health concerns? I will briefly give you an introduction to the nanoscale, talk about properties and toxicity, product life cycle, human health risk assessment, the data gaps and the uncertainties associated with them, and I will end with some opportunities for all of us. I have no relationships to disclose. So the nanoscale. Nanomaterials are very, very small. We cannot see them even under the light microscope. And in terms of scale, let me see, I can use the arrow, you can see it. Here we have 1 millimeter, 1 micrometer, and 1 nanometer. And in terms of scale, we have mammalian cells here, viruses here, and in the nanoscale, about the DNA molecule is about 2 nanometers across. And the official definition of a nanomaterial in the US is between 1 and 100 nanometers in any one dimension. Nanomaterials have been all around us forever. They're naturally occurring in ocean spray or from friction and erosion. They're also incidentally generated from combustion engines and laser printers at home and welding fumes, for example. And we know them in air pollution research as ultrafines. Any material under 100 nanometers in diameter is considered an ultrafine, but they don't define what these materials are. This talk is centered on engineered nanomaterials, nanomaterials that are designed to have specific functions. This is why we want them. So they have amazing properties, and we really want all the benefit of these properties. And I will run through some of them. They have a tremendous surface area per gram of material because they are so small. The size and size distribution is really important. In each of these tubes, we have only quantum gold quantum dots. The difference is the size of the material. So you can really tune the functionality by creating different size nanomaterials. The shape, they come in all types of shapes, tubes, rod, wires, spheres, and sheets. Here you have carbon nanotubes, which come in single nanotubes or in multi-walled carbon nanotubes. This is a multi-walled carbon nanotube, like a kitchen towel rolled up. We also have silver nanowires. Here's a quantum dot from metals. And this is an engineered nanomaterial cage with a payload inside. Very cool, very cool. So they can be composed of organic material, graphene sheets, they can be metal, quantum dots, or they can be hybrids. Where the rubber hits the road is the surface modification. You can take single carbon nanotubes and change the surface to make them positively charged, negatively charged, hydrophilic, hydrophobic, magnetic, or make them adhere to certain organs. So this is really where we create this tremendous number of different nanomaterials because they all have different functions, and we are after these functions. And the surface also determines whether or not these materials will agglomerate, meaning stick together. Am I going backwards? Apparently. Okay, I have to press the other button. Toxicities. There are very few general assumptions we can make about toxicities because there are so many different nanomaterials, each with their functions. I just listed some general statements that we can do based on the limited toxicity data that is out there. There's very few toxicity data out there for the individual nanomaterials, and then there is a lot of toxicity data that is not published because the industry who uses and makes all these materials is not very forthcoming with this data. We see local effects. For example, because these materials are so small, they can squeeze easily through the cell membrane. We find them in the nucleus. We find them also in the mitochondria. We see them accumulated in the first organ of contact in the body, be that the stomach or the lungs. But then a portion of these materials can translocate. They can move to other organs with the blood or with the lymph system. We see them going into the spleen, the liver, the kidney. They can cross the blood-brain barrier they can cross into the placenta, they can cross the placenta, and we see some reproductive effects from titanium dioxide in mice, for example. Acute effects inside the cell, for example, silver nanomaterials can shed these silver atoms which create reactive oxygen species, and it is these reactive oxygen species that cause the damage in the cells. We see inflammation responses, immune responses, but we also see mutations, particularly with silver, because the silver creates these reactive oxygen that attacks the DNA. We have only animal studies in a controlled setting, animal studies and in vitro studies for chronic studies. We see fibrosis from carbon nanotubes, and some multi-walled carbon nanotubes have asbestos-like effects. We see lung tumors in mice from titanium dioxide. We also see from low concentration, long-term exposure of lung epithelial cells, a transformation of these cells. This is in vitro. My question is, are we really looking at the most relevant, the most significant toxic endpoints, or are we chasing something that where we really should be looking for something else? This slide, everything on this slide, these are only estimates. We know very little about the actual production volumes and how much is produced in the US. Overall, we think 50% of all the nanomaterials in the world are produced in the US, roughly 150,000 tons per year. What are these nanomaterials that are produced? These are just estimates based on 2010 interviews with industry officials. We are talking roughly 50,000 tons of metal oxides. Here we have titanium dioxide, silicon dioxide, iron, zinc oxide, aluminum oxide. Roughly 50,000 pounds per year. Very little compared, for example, for the bulk titanium dioxide that is produced in the range of 5 million tons per year. But for nanomaterials, we use only very little material. Now, what happens with all this material? Where do they go? We don't know. There's no labeling requirement, neither for consumer products nor for construction or commercial products. There is a website that is crowdsourced where people can basically nominate that they found on the label a reference to nanomaterials that is done from the Woodrow Wilson Center. And we see in 2013, when it was last updated, at least 1,600 consumer products that have nanomaterials in them. We have about just under 500 commercial products, particularly in the construction industry. And what are these materials? They are all around us. Coatings, paint, and pigments. For example, in textiles, you probably are aware of these athletic clothing that is not smelly. This is most likely due to silver nanoparticles in these textiles. Personal care product, the vanishing zinc sunscreen nanomaterials, zinc nanomaterials, but also in cosmetics and sunscreen, as I mentioned. Electronics, optics, the swipeable screen on our cell phones, silver nanowires most likely, but also used in sensors. Energy and environment, very big industry for batteries, which is a hot topic. Catalysts, because they have this tremendous surface. And at these surfaces, we have biological and chemical reactions taking place. Automotive, and particularly in the medical industry, drug delivery is very important. And we all want these beneficial effects of these materials. The question is, what are the unintended consequences of our use? I would like to look at the product life cycle of any given material. We can use silver nanomaterials. Throughout this product life cycle, we will have releases into the environment, either air, water, or soil. But we don't really know how many. And we will have workers' exposure as well as consumer exposures, but we don't know where and how much. So when the raw material, say silver or titanium dioxide, is mined or created, we will have workers' exposure. But in the developmental stage, usually in the laboratory, we will have workers' exposure too. And often workers are protected by under the hood, having the HEPA filter, which in many cases is efficient for nanomaterials. But my question is, what happens to the HEPA filter? Where does it go? And then we have transportation, storage, and manufacturing of this original nanomaterial. It's being incorporated often in other products, for example, into plastics. And we have, again, workers' exposures. At the consumer end, or at the construction material, we will have exposure of consumers, either directly from cosmetics, but also from releases over time from the aging matrix, whether it's tires or whether it's construction materials, and the byproducts that are created. At the end of life stage, we will have recycling, most likely, of these materials. There will be either incineration of the waste or landfilling, or it's put into the wastewater. There's a washing machine from Samsung that calls the Silver Care product line that actually releases silver nanoparticles into the washing cycle, and then it goes to the wastewater treatment plant. What is the environmental fate and transport of these materials after they are released? We don't know that. So overall, we have exposures to humans and releases to the environment that we really don't know. Here's an accident, something like that keeps me awake at night. Fortunately, this was not in California. This was in France in 2011. This truck spilled, transported nano-titanium dioxide, and each of those large bags is about 1,500 pounds. The French authorities at that time determined this is not a hazardous material, and they had transportation workers clean it up. I can see safety vests, but I don't know whether they have any respiratory protection. You can see the road is wet, there was some runoff, it's on the soil, and you can also see residential housing in the back. So as we look at this in terms of risk assessment, we are trying to identify the hazards. We don't know, there's no requirement for these facilities anywhere in the US to tell anybody that they are producing nanomaterials. So we don't know where these nanomaterials are stored or manufactured, and if there's an accident, we have a release of unknown engineered nanomaterials. There's no standard method for sampling of environmental media, except probably for air pollution, where we have the ultrafines. And how do we identify and quantify an unknown engineered nanomaterial? Dose response, as I mentioned, there's very little toxicity data. The metrics are not even resolved, how we report the dose, because milligrams per kilogram body weight doesn't really make sense, because the mass is irrelevant. So should we take particle number, surface area, or surface reactivity? And the lack of toxicity data and appropriate toxic endpoints that I mentioned already. Exposure assessment. If we don't know where these facilities are, we cannot identify and track worker cohorts, which is usually for public health the first line of investigation to determine what are their exposures and what are potential health effects. And we don't know any of consumer exposures. Risk characterization is really difficult, assessing cancer or non-cancer risk, because we barely even have animal data, and then only for inhalation, and only short-term usually. And we haven't even looked at developmental and reproductive toxicology on a larger scale. So risk management, we are left with few options. There are some safety data sheets. They are usually not very informative. Some actually recommend dust masks, which is not helpful. And my question is, what are the internal practices in the industry to keep their workers safe? We do have two guidances from NIOSH. In 2011, they published a recommended exposure level for nanotitanium dioxide of 300 micrograms per cubic meter. Based on their review of the literature, it's a potential occupational carcinogen, the nanotitanium dioxide. And then in 2013, they reviewed the literature for carbon nanotubes and carbon nanofibers, and they came up with an REL of 1 microgram per cubic meter, because they compared carbon nanotubes and carbon nanofibers to other reference compounds, including asbestos, and they found larger or similar effects than asbestos. And in 2014, the International Agency for Research on Cancer looked at a particular multivalent carbon nanotube, 7 it's called, and determined it's a potential or a possible human carcinogen. This is the only guidance that we have for nanomaterials. And again, it's guidance. The industry does not have to follow these. So going back to the question, why is it so difficult to determine potential public health concerns? Because of these great gaps in data, knowledge, infrastructure that lead to these uncertainties that we are dealing with. And I'll just mention some of them I mentioned already, some I have not. Overall, there is little discussion of engineered nanomaterials in the field of public health, though I think it's really necessary to have that discussion. And it's probably related to funding, because over the last 10 years, a lot of funding went into basic research. But public health, the applied toxicology, was not funded. We don't know where the nanomaterial facilities are located. By the way, only France is the only country, to my knowledge, that made registration of nanofacilities mandatory. And they jumped from about 19 voluntary registrants to over 900 in a year. We have no knowledge of the worker cohorts. There's the published toxicology data is often not easily reproduced. This is a difficult problem to deal with because we rely on these peer-reviewed toxicity data studies. It's very hard for the researchers to publish negative data, which would be very important for us. We would like to know what are the effects where this is not a toxic material, or what are the concentrations. We have very little information on environmental fate and transport. If you order an engineered nanomaterial from any online shop, you don't really know whether it's exactly what it says on the label, the size distribution. There may be impurities in there, and there may be endotoxins. So a toxicologist who uses this material in their tox study, unless they really test the material, they will not know is the toxicity that they find related to the impurities or the endotoxins or actually the nanomaterial functionalities. It's very difficult. Very few useful safety data sheets that we have. Unknown exposures of the general public, no labeling of the products required. And we have unknown releases during the life cycle of the compound into the environment. We don't really communicate this to the public. There's a lot of rah-rah-rah for engineered nanomaterials, but if we want to keep and maintain the trust of the public, we also have to communicate what are the uncertainties and what are the potential risks. So otherwise, if there is a bad surprise in the future, that we at least have established that we are aware of the uncertainties. So I think that risk communication is really important for the public. And as I mentioned, few standard methods. If we don't have a toxicity standard method, how can we compare results between different studies? I want to end up with some opportunities that I see. We really need a robust discussion of this in the field of public health. And it's not even considered an emerging concern because, as I learned yesterday, 10 years ago or so, there were some sessions at APHA on engineered nanomaterials. I don't know why it was not kept up. But I would really recommend all of us to get involved and ask some questions in your own organizations. There are also existing networks that are looking into nanomaterials. For example, at the Society of Toxicology, they have a specialty section. So does the American Industrial Hygienist Association. And then at the National Nanotechnology Coordination Office, which is a US federal site, they have facilitated communities of research. And you can find them under this email address, us-eu.org. These are 7 communities of research. Anybody can join them. And they are all related to engineered nanomaterials, environmental safety, and health. I want to mention particularly the last one, human toxicity. I'm the co-chair of the human toxicity for this US-EU community of research, and I want to invite you all to at least have a look. Shameless plug. So, thank you. And I want to end with the summary. There are so many gaps in data, knowledge, and infrastructure. We have an increasing number of consumer products and commercial products, but there are unknown exposures to consumers and workers. There are lots of uncertainties, but no discussion of this in the public health field. And I want to acknowledge the CDPH Nano Group, especially Rick Kreutzer, Barbara Materna, Jed Waldman, Janice Prudhomme, Claudia Christ, and Jeff Wong from Cal EPA. Thank you.
Perfect.